From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A decision is coming, ultimately from the White House, on the Keystone XL pipeline. Sooner or later, we will build it or not build it. To bring heavy, dirty, new oil down from Canada. Proponents say jobs and cheap energy. Opponents say it's the path to climate change hell. And out where it would run, from Alberta down into Nebraska, writer Tony Horowitz has been there this hour on Point on the would-be trail of the Keystone XL pipeline. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you say yay or nay to the Keystone XL and why? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Tuesday, environmental activists marched a giant 100-yard inflatable pipeline around the Capitol building in Washington, protesting the proposed Keystone XL. 100 No KXL, no Keystone XL, the whole planet on the brink, the message there. The next day, though, on CNBC, Republican Senator John Barrasso of Wyoming saying the president should have promoted Keystone XL pipeline right there in his State of the Union address.
We have 62 members of the Senate who supported every governor along the route. It's important for energy jobs. The State Department predicts 42,000 jobs, good-paying jobs, energy security, less money sent to overseas to some folks who aren't necessarily our best friends and allies on issues. So I think it's a winner for the country, but the president should have embraced it.
And on Friday, the State Department report came down. Lots of attention to that. We're going to talk with Tony Horowitz in a moment. He's been up in tar sands country, oil sands, as the Canadians like to say. But first, to where this decision-making process stands now and the meaning of the report that came on Friday from Washington. Coral Davenport joins us, environment and energy reporter for the New York Times. Coral, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. It's good to be here.
Lots of headlines, including in your paper, suggesting that this pushes Keystone XL closer to a green light.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The report, when President Obama gave his big climate change speech in June, he said that he would, his bottom line was that he would not approve the Keystone pipeline if it turns out that it will significantly exacerbate the problem of carbon emissions. That was sort of the key takeaway from what he said. That was his key criteria. And so this report, the bottom line of this report is that the oil is going to get out of those of those oil sands whether or not the pipeline is built. In other words, the oil will get out, it will be built, it will be burnt, and it will contribute, it will burn, and the pipeline probably won't significantly contribute to whether or not that happens. So it does seem like it meets the president's criteria for not significantly exacerbating carbon emissions. So in that way, it does seem like it opens the door for approval. However, there are elements of Friday's report that environmentalists did take heart in. It did have some scenarios that indicated that, if, for example, the demand for oil went down, if prices for oil went down, then potentially that could then building of the pipeline would be more likely to get more oil out of there than if it weren't built. But it's also key to remember that this report is just one step in the process. The report doesn't make any recommendations. I think it opens the door. It gives Obama cover for approval of the pipeline, but it doesn't make any recommendations. And the next step of the process, it goes to the desk of Secretary John Kerry, Secretary of State John Kerry, who is going to weigh a whole array of considerations before he makes a decision.
So, I mean, it's so interesting because you say it says it wouldn't exacerbate carbon emissions. Of course, it does say this is very dirty. This is 17% or something like that. It says dirtier than alternatives in petrochemicals. It's just, And here's maybe the key line on this. It says, approval, the report on Friday, approval or denial of any one crude oil transport project, including the proposed project, that's Keystone XL, is unlikely to significantly impact the rate of extraction in the oil sands or the demand for heavy crude at refineries in the United States. I guess, Coral, that's where people are looking and saying, well, there it is. There's no roadblock there. If the president wants to look into this report and find a way to say, no, if he wants to do that, is there a grounding he could find in here, Coral?
You pointed out exactly that. That is the key line. That's the line that seems to indicate that the Keystone would pass its climate test. It doesn't technically yet go to the president's desk. Right now, it goes to the desk of Secretary of State John Kerry. It also goes open for public comment. The report is open for public comment for 30 days. It also goes to 8 other agencies. It goes to the Environmental Protection Agency, Interior, Department of Homeland Security, Defense, several other agencies. They get 90 days to weigh in, and they'll weigh the broader impacts of the pipeline, the economic impact, foreign relations, it's the decision's impact on U.S.-Canadian relationships, energy security. All of these will be part of the broader decision-making process. But it's important to remember that it's the Secretary of State who gets to make the next call. And Secretary of State John Kerry does have a long history of caring very deeply about the issue of climate change, and he wants to make climate change a legacy issue for himself as Secretary of State. So this is going to be a really interesting decision for him. And he gets to look at that report, but he also gets to consider a lot of other options as well. And he can decide that if he wants, that even if this pipeline itself, if no single project, would significantly contribute to the rate of development that the U.S. may not want to contribute, still may not want to sort of add something, or he may want to make use this as a symbolic decision. There's a whole array. He doesn't have to make the decision based just on this report.
Of course, Canadians and others are putting the pressure on, saying we are rapidly building out rail transport capacity here, and pipeline or no pipeline, we're going to move this oil. That puts the pressure on, doesn't it, Coral?
The rail transport issue is very interesting. It looks like, and this is sort of one of the ways in which the pressure is possibly decreasing on the pipeline story, on the pipeline issue, because right now the demand is so high and the price for oil is so high that it is getting out by rail. But that does bring with it a whole other set of concerns. We've seen a lot of reports as oil is being moved by rail of derailments, of explosions, of accidents. It turns out that this is potentially not the most safe way to move oil. But it does look like even if the pipeline is not built, then the oil will get out by rail.
So here we are 2 days after the State Department long-awaited report finally came out. Who seems more heartened or more discouraged to you, Coral, in this debate?
I would say that the oil industry proponents of the pipeline are looking at this report and saying, at this point, it's really hard to find a way for the administration to say no based on the president's criteria. However, I think environmentalists have combed through the report and found pieces of the report that give them hope, that give them some sort of silver lining, and they are looking very much, they are placing all their hopes on Secretary of State John Kerry. They know that he is kind of the next person to make in the decision-making process. And so they are planning to, what's been interesting about the protests and the rallies and the efforts to influence the decision so far is that the preparation of this report has been done by kind of career-level bureaucrats and lawyers and economists who are really focused just on the technical aspects of the problem. Now it really does go to one person making a decision. And so we're going to see the protesters and the environmentalists rallying outside the State Department already. Tom Steyer, the billionaire who is a major Obama donor and opposes the pipeline, has sent a letter personally to Kerry detailing the reasons that he thinks this is a bad idea. It's all going to be focused on Secretary of State John Kerry. And I think there's going to be a big push to try to influence his decision making.
Can you imagine institutionally John Kerry actually making the decision? I mean, doesn't it still, even if he makes a decision, isn't it bottom line at the White House? Isn't the president looking over his shoulder? Would he step in front of the president and just cut President Obama out of this, Coral?
Well, here's how the decision making process works. Secretary of State John Kerry gets to make the next decision. However, he will do so with input from 8 other agencies. And if the head of any other one of those agencies disagrees with the Secretary of State, then it gets bumped up to the president. So that's the process. And the thinking is that there may very well be a disagreement, in which case it goes to the president. Those other agencies have 90 days to weigh in. So I think it'll be at least 3 months before we get to that next stage. So, I mean, that's the thing. This is going to be dragged out for several months longer, it looks like.
Dragged out for a long time already. Big protests and a big push at the same time for this pipeline. Coral Davenport with the New York Times, covering energy and the environment there. Coral, thanks very much for being with us today.
Sure. Great to be with you.
There's protests in Washington over the Keystone XL pipeline, but things are moving here. Rail cars are moving full of oil. Tar sands are being developed. We're talking in this hour about the Keystone XL pipeline with writer Tony Horwitz. He's followed the path where some would like to build it down from Canada into the USA. Others are fighting bitterly, saying, no, we heard them right there. But listen to labor leaders. Of course, they see jobs here. Here in April last year, Terry O'Sullivan, president of Laborers International Union of North America, saying, let's get this done. Let's build Keystone XL.
We're about America. We're about American jobs. I'm sick and tired. Can you imagine paying these damn crazy countries that we get our oil from instead of our brothers and sisters in Canada?
Meanwhile, the work goes on. Here's the sound of the heavy machinery up in Alberta, Canada. Tony Horwitz has been right there. He joins me now from Woods Hole, Massachusetts. He's author of the new ebook, Boom, Oil, Money, Cowboys, Strippers, and the Energy Rush That Could Change America Forever, A Long, Strange Journey Along the Keystone XL Pipeline. It's available today on Amazon, iTunes, Byliner.com. You can find an excerpt at our website and a gallery of photos, terrific photos from Tony's journey there as well, onpointradio.org. Tony Horwitz, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Put us right there in tar sands country, out where it's being dug, it's been dug. What's it look like, feel like, smell like, Tony?
Well, I've been to a lot of mining areas, whether it's Appalachia or copper mines, and I've seen oil wells in the Middle East that I used to cover, but I have never seen a man-mauled landscape quite like the oil sands of northern Alberta. You can't even call it a landscape because the earth has simply been peeled of its skin. This was once a forest with peat bog. All the trees are gone. The peat bog has been rolled up like carpet. And then they strip the earth down to a depth of about 200 feet to get at this sand that is rich with bitumen oil. So it's a, it's a really a moonscape. It's quite something to see.
And the development is quite far along. Give us a sense of the scale.
Yeah, I think that was the single most striking thing to me. When I was up there in October, no one seemed very concerned about whether the XL was going to be built or not. They are just ramping up production at this insane level. It's been booming for 10 years. They expect production to double over the next 6 or 8 years. Everybody is expanding. So you have this 80-mile corridor that is just being strip mined as well as drilled. Strip mining is not the only process. And just this tremendous amount of oil gushing out of northern Alberta.
Current output, you remind us, is about 2 million barrels a day. Keystone XL pipeline couldn't carry all that.
No, the XL on its own has a capacity of 830,000 barrels a day, and 100,000 of that is set aside for oil from the Bakken region in North Dakota and Montana. So it would carry about 730,000 barrels of from the oil sands of Alberta, which is significant, but it's only a fraction of what the production currently is and will become. So I think the XL is really a window into a much bigger drama, which is this unbelievable energy revolution going on, not just in Canada, but also in North America. We are really becoming the Saudi Arabia of the Western Hemisphere, and I don't think Americans have fully grasped all the economic, foreign policy, and environmental implications.
You're right. Alberta's bitumen holds the third largest oil reserve in the world, more than in Iraq or Iran, enough power to power North America for decades. But the opposition is bitter. Your photos won't diminish that. I mean, it's got a kind of a Mordor look to it once it's stripped. And it's way up there. You're up in Fort McMurray. This is further north on the planet than Moscow. Winter temperatures averaging -2, -60, no problem. But plenty of people up there, and they call it Fort McCrack. Why?
Because it's a terrible drug problem. People claim that cocaine goes through your system more quickly, so that if you want to pass a drug test, they're often drug tested, these workers, it's better to do coke or crack than to smoke pot, which lingers in your system much longer. So there is a tremendous drug problem there, to the point where Somali gangs from Toronto have muscled in on the action. But it's also called Fort McMoney because it genuinely is offering tremendous opportunities to people, almost all from eastern Canada, where the economy is not as strong. And you have high school grads, 20-year-olds out there making $100,000 a year. And very much the same thing is going on in North Dakota. North Dakota, the oil boom there, is really a U.S. Version of what's happening in Alberta, although even rawer because it's more recent.
Building the Keystone XL pipeline is a matter of a couple of years, $5-7 billion. What about the tar sands, oil sands exploitation in Alberta? How long is that expected to go on, Tony?
Oh, decades. One of the biggest companies there has applied for a new mine that will have a life of 5 decades. You go up there and every major oil company, every major oil player is there. You've got Shell, you've got Exxon, you've got the Koch brothers, you've got PetroChina, you name it. It is really, it's like the Klondike. It's this absolute gold rush, in this case for oil, from around the world. So this is going to go on for decades, unless really demand and the oil price comes down significantly. Really, the Achilles heel of oil sands is that they're very difficult and costly to extract, and they're landlocked, so you have to transport them a long way. Most experts believe, and the State Department report said that, if the price falls to, say, $65 a barrel for oil, we're somewhere in the 90s at the moment, I don't know today's price, this may no longer be economical. So I think that's the one thing that could bring it to a halt.
So is the Keystone XL, do they see it up there as a cork in the bottle? I mean, you know how dire the warnings have been. As you quote, and everyone does, NASA's James Hansen saying a couple of years back that unlock all this oil, explode this vast pool of dirty oil, and it will be game over for the climate because it is so much dirtier to get it out there into the world. Is the Keystone XL pipeline now holding it up? If it never gets built, does it somehow stay in the ground, stay in Alberta?
Well, I guess I feel the State Department report got it right on the narrow issue of the XL in and of itself. If it's not built, I mean, in addition to all the production, you see just unbelievable construction of rail facilities, pipelines everywhere you go. They are trying to get it out by whatever means possible. So I think the State Department got that right. I think also, again, on the narrow issue of the oil that the XL would carry, that in itself may not be a lethal injection for the planet. But if you look at the broader of this escalating production from the oil sands, I think it's very serious. And I think we need to grapple with that and say, You know, what do we want here? And it's undeniable that jobs, not so much from the pipeline itself, there are a lot of jobs here. In North Dakota, it's very striking. Again, different oil field, but similar story. You see African Americans from Mississippi, Hispanics from Florida and California, working class whites from the Midwest, everywhere else, out there making $100,000 or more a year, able to live a middle-class life. And I don't think we can leave that out of the equation, as frankly I think environmentalists tend to do.
The Keystone Pipeline, the State Department report said, would support 42,000 jobs over 2 years of construction. That is direct and indirect, contribute $3.5 billion to the economy. Said about 3,900 of those jobs would be temporary construction jobs. Once it's built, the pipeline would support 50 jobs. So everybody has a different calculus that they do here. Tony Horowitz has been right down along the intended would-be path, if it's built, of Keystone XL, and we'll follow on down that path. Tony, callers for you. Right here in Canada, Montreal, Brian is calling. Hi, Brian, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I wanted to give an outsider's opinion, maybe just to get a start on this discussion. I have nothing I can possibly say about the route inside America and its consequences inside America, but I can tell you what I see as the consequences of the KXL on the government of Canada, which is by far the most conservative government we've ever had in our history. If think of it as a government run by Dick Cheney on steroids.
Okay.
He's an absolutely ruthless calculator, and his power depends completely on the success of the KXL as an export route, because he has an election in 2 years. To get back to the point, if America has issues about the climate consequences of this oil, and they are serious, I don't doubt it, you are in the best position ever to affect those consequences by striking a really tough diplomatic deal with the government of Canada.
What would a tough deal look like, Brian? What does that mean? It's oil coming or not coming, right? Or what?
Well, no, there are many, many ways to exploit this resource. You can do it in ways which mitigate the carbon consequences of doing it, among many other technical alternatives. I'm an engineer. I've spent my lifetime in this. Mm-hmm. You could develop ways of heating this material which do not have consequences for the greenhouse gases. Think nuclear reactors. We have a technology in Canada we've been using since World War II, which has the least proliferation consequences. Our heavy water reactors, which are capable of producing tons and tons of heat, would be an excellent resource, but then you got to say, okay, do we want to live with a heavy water reactor as a source of energy? That gets rid of a lot of the greenhouse gas consequences of exploiting the resource. Doesn't change the downstream end, but at least it changes the topstream end. And let me tell you, if America's KXL refusal forces our government to look to Asia, the consequences of exporting this oil are to put a massive series of pipelines through the Rockies to the West Coast, where tankers, with all the Exxon Valdez consequences, risk polluting the Pacific.
Now that's interesting, Brian. You're in Canada, engineer, and you're saying green light XL, but put lots of provisions on it to clean up the whole situation.
That's right. And if it is an issue for your Secretary of State, Kerry, he is by far in the best position to see a worldwide consequence of changing the oil economics. And that's a question for American diplomacy. But if Kerry's the key player for the next little while, keep in mind he knows what it will do for Middle East politics, too.
Brian, in Montreal, thank you for your call. Tony Horowitz, here's Brian envisioning a nuclear power plant sitting on top of this oil to reduce the fossil fuel emissions that would be required just to extract and heat it up so it can be moved, and saying, in his case, do it or the Chinese will do it. It'll go over the Rocky Mountains and off it goes. What are you hearing up there, on the ground? Are people expecting that they will get a Keystone XL? Do they think the U.S. Will put big provisions on it? Do you see them anticipating American leverage to clean it up?
Well, this is a very good talking point for the industry because it carries some truth. If the XL is denied, the oil will come out by rail, which consumes more fuel and is potentially more dangerous to life and limb, as we've seen from different recent derailments. And yes, there are many proposals to, as Brian said, to build a pipeline across to the Pacific and then send it to China. In climate change, exchange terms, it doesn't matter where this this resource is burned. So simply keeping it out of the U.S. won't, well, we already are getting it in the U.S., but keeping this greater flow out of the U.S. won't keep it in the ground. I can't speak to the nuclear issue. I would say that even if the anti-XL campaign fails in stopping the XL, it's accomplished a tremendous amount. One, it's made this pipeline much safer than it otherwise would have been. TransCanada is incorporating dozens of features not normally required at the behest of U.S. regulators. And the industry is on notice that if they propose future such projects, they're going to face this kind of opposition. So I think, if nothing else, the campaign has significantly slowed the development, and will have a big impact on the future.
Dave in Menominee, Michigan. Dave, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Tom. You know, the clip that you played with Senator Barrasso earlier, he says the things that I hear mostly on the right. He said that this pipeline is important for our jobs and energy. And we hear that this nuance that we feel is that this is supposed to be good for a lot of jobs, and it makes people that I know on the right that argue for this, they feel that this oil is going to be our oil, that this is our oil to use, and it's going to bring down the prices. And, you know, I thought that this oil is supposed to go out on the world market. Maybe that'll affect, you know, the price of oil. I doubt it. But the argument, the people that are willing to extract this stuff, think that it's because this oil is for us.
Yeah, but follow the pipeline. Follow the money, follow the pipeline. It, of course, goes right on down to the ports in Texas. Dave, thanks for your call, Tony. And from there to the world, I mean, the Keystone XL only goes down as far as Nebraska. But then it feeds into ready and waiting pipelines that Dave is exactly right, isn't he? We'll take this everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Well, currently a lot of it goes to refineries in the Midwest. And then, yes, it will carry a tremendous amount to these enormous heavy crude refineries on the Gulf Coast. The export issue is tricky because technically it's almost impossible to – not almost impossible. It's difficult to export crude from the U.S. There's a law dating back to the 1970s, when we were very concerned about energy security, and the idea was the less oil that goes out of our country, the more we will have energy independence.
So refine it and it goes. It goes either way.
It can go out under certain circumstances, and we are already a net exporter of certain refined petroleum products. But I personally don't think it's either financially sensible to put it on ships to China, or legally there are issues. This ban on exports could be lifted, so it's a potential issue, but I think it's most of this oil will certainly be refined and used in this country.
For it, up in Canada, as you came across the border following its trail down into the States, what did you find along this path out Montana way and in Dakotas?
Right. Well, it's fascinating because it's different every province and state you pass through. The XL is, in a sense, blessed, at least for the first 1,000 miles of its path, because if you're a pipeline operator, obviously you want the most direct route from A to B. Every turn costs money.
And it's flat and pretty empty.
Exactly. You also want it to be empty because you don't want opposition and you don't want the risk of spills in rivers and drinking supplies, etc. And this goes through not only one of the lonelier stretches of North America, but one of the most conservative. We're talking deeply rural, overwhelmingly white, overwhelmingly Republican. And at least till you get to Nebraska, that works in XL's favor.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Keystone XL pipeline with writer Tony Horowitz. He's followed the path where some would like to build it down from Canada into the USA. Others are fighting bitterly, saying, no, you can join us this hour. What do you think? Did we step closer to building Keystone XL with the State Department's report on Friday? What's your question for Tony Horowitz about what he saw out there? How do you picture tar sands country? Lots of pushback and lots of push for from industry and labor as well. Here's an ad from NextGen Climate Action, San Francisco-based, focused on climate change issues, attacking TransCanada's claim that Keystone Pipeline will help Americans. Ran on MSNBC before the State of the Union address last Tuesday.
TransCanada's ads say the oil will help make America energy independent. But under oath, TransCanada won't commit to selling us one single barrel. The oil lobbyists and politicians, they take Americans for suckers. Keystone means more profit for investors like China, more power for their economy, and more carbon pollution for the world. Keystone's a sucker's deal for America. Just say no to Keystone.
Okay, there's the just say no message, but there's a lot of push for yes and no big roadblock in the State Department's report on Friday, as a lot of people are reading it. Tony Horowitz has written a new ebook about Keystone XL territory. He's been all the way up to the tar sands origins and then right down along its trail into the United States through Montana, South Dakota, down into Nebraska and nearly Oklahoma. He joins it's called Boom, Oil, Money, Cowboys, Strippers, and the Energy Rush That Could Change America Forever. A long, strange journey along the Keystone XL pipeline. Tony, take us out there a little more. Bring us across the border into the United States. You've got all kinds of territory that you're crossing here, and you say it's conservative. And by and large, people open to it, want the jobs, but you've got a sort of a dappled reporting here on pro and con.
Yeah. I mean, one of the joys of this trip really is that I drove for 4,000 miles and was only on an interstate for a few hours during a blizzard in South Dakota. And you see a very different slice of America when you're on small rural roads. And, you know, you go to these bars in Montana where there are kids at the bar. No one cares. Six-year-olds sitting at the bar, 12-year-olds driving. It's really the Wild West out there. And yes, politically very conservative. And they're focused on the jobs, the benefits for their county in terms of tax revenues, the infrastructure improvements that will come with roads and power lines to service the pipeline facilities. And, you know, what comes with that is a lot of climate change denial and a lot of hatred of Obama and of liberals in general. So I think part of the pro-pipeline sentiment I encountered all across the Northern Plains, this issue has become a sort of proxy for the broader war between red and blue America. And they feel they have to take sides. And so it's not just about the specific issues.
Gwen is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Gwen, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, I have about a million things to say, but I guess I'm only entitled to one or two.
Mm-hmm.
So I have stood with Republicans at the White House from the area that the Keystone Pipeline would go flow through, who are there because their farms are being taken away, because they are concerned about their the aquifer, where their water comes from, and the water from that whole area. So there's purple. There are purple people who are very concerned about the the environmental impact and economic impact to them of the Keystone Pipeline. I was calling specifically to mention that there are pipelines that already exist that are that are carrying tar sands oil into the United States, and there have already been many spills, particularly, for example, the million gallons of tar sands oil that poured into the Kalamazoo River in the summer of 2010 in Michigan, and that is still we're still attempting to clean that up along 40 miles of the river. They're still contaminated.
Gwen, let me take that point in particular to Tony, if I may, because he's looking at people out along the Keystone Path worried about that. You got big aquifer out there people are worried about. What about that perspective, Tony?
Yeah, no, Gwen is absolutely right. And this is why Nebraska in particular is fascinating. Take Holt County, Nebraska, one of the most conservative in the country. 82%, I believe, voted for a candidate other than Obama in the last election. This is an absolute hotbed of resistance to the pipeline, mainly over that water issue. Nebraska, or most of Nebraska, sits atop this huge aquifer, the Ogallala Aquifer, which is to Nebraska what sun is to Florida. And there is absolute terror that a spill we'll get into it. And the example Gwen cited is the most troubling. This was a rupture in a pipeline, not TransCanada, Enbridge in Michigan in 2010 that spilled an enormous amount, 20,000 barrels, I believe, into the Kalamazoo River. And the problem with bitumen oil is that it's diluted with chemicals. But once those chemicals evaporate, as happened in the Kalamazoo, the bitumen, which is very heavy and dense, like
melted asphalt. It's almost like asphalt. Yeah,
sinks to the bottom. So this has become the costliest and most difficult cleanup of an onshore oil spill in American history. So, you know, this, putting the climate change issue aside, this is the biggest single rallying point for opposition to the pipeline, and again, particularly in Nebraska.
On the ground, along the way, at least in Nebraska territory, of course, then the other argument comes back, well, it's coming out, it's the rail facilities are being built up like crazy. December 30th, two trains collide in North Dakota, one of them carrying crude. Here was that report, Tony, from Reuters.
A train collision in North Dakota causes a major fire and series of explosions, sending a mushroom cloud deep into the sky.
And here's Steve Forbes, editor-in-chief of Forbes, of course, conservative. He wants the pipeline to be built, says you don't build it, you're going to have trains and accidents.
If you don't approve pipelines, we're going to be moving more and more oil on trains, which is just begging for accidents.
Here on Yahoo Finance's The Daily Ticket. What about that concern, Tony, out in the territory where you were traveling? If it's not a pipeline, it's going to be rail, and that's got its own issues.
Yeah, it's a legitimate concern. I was in North Dakota as well, and you see what are called oil can cars roaring past, sort of 100 or more cars carrying nothing but crude, just going, you know, one after the other. I also saw the site, a farm with a terrible oil spill from a pipeline. None of these options are risk-free. I'll just say the rail thing is a little more complicated than proponents of the pipeline make it out to be, because this heavy bitumen oil is not as volatile as conventional oil. For instance, that derailment in North Dakota, the one in Quebec that killed 47 people. Bitumen oil is not as explosive. As I explained, it can be far deadlier if it gets into water. But the risk of the kind of accidents you're talking about may not be as high as expected. But no. If you feel it's going to get out one way or another, generally speaking, I think the consensus is that a pipeline is safer. You're not burning gas to move it. This is a part of the difficult equation of figuring this out.
Got lots of response online. Cindy sees it coming, maybe, and says this is an unadulterated disaster, pure and simple. Neil says, tar sands bitumen extraction equal Mordor. That looks sort of like your photos at our website, that vision, Tony. Here's Jeff says, whether or not the pipeline's built, the tar sands oil will be shipped using rail, which is how it's been moved now. There's that. It's going to come somehow. Yar looks at this as cheap energy and says, wait a minute, please define cheap energy. I mean, if you take the James Hansen view that it's game over for climate change, just puts us on a sort of path to climate change hell, then it doesn't look cheap, Tony.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the price thing is complicated because, as an earlier caller mentioned, this is a global market. The price isn't set simply by what local supply is. I guess what I would argue is that a steady supply, to put it in drug terms, a reliable fix of oil from Canada and from the Bakken,
which a pipeline delivers,
which the pipeline would deliver, makes it harder for we as a nation to kick or curtail our habit. We won't have the diplomatic complications that come with getting a lot of oil from, say, the Middle East. I mean, we'll still be importing oil from other sources, but less. We'll be less inclined, perhaps, to pursue alternative energy. So there are consequences of that as well that I don't think we've addressed. And I think the foreign policy implications are huge. If we are much, much less reliant on Middle East oil, for instance, what does that mean for our relationship with Saudi Arabia, for our tendency to meddle in the Middle East generally? What will it mean for not-so-stable oil regimes like Nigeria? There are some very big consequences coming down the road that are impossible to predict, but I think we need to think through as we discuss this issue.
President Obama, of course, headed to Saudi Arabia himself before too long. One can only imagine that the royal family there is going to want to know about his decision on Keystone XL. I can imagine them learning before Americans learn. Tracy in New Orleans is calling. Tracy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
You were here in New Orleans last week.
Yes, indeed.
You saw firsthand the issues that we're facing here with regards to rising sea levels.
I sure did. They are big.
They are huge. What is being ignored by not only the State Department report, but the media, is that every single drop of oil that is being burned, whether it is foreign or domestic, exacerbates global warming, exacerbates the melting of polar ice, and a further rise of global sea levels. And our senators here in Louisiana, Mary Landrieu and David Vitter, are among those who have chosen to support the fossil fuel industry and this pipeline in the name of temporary jobs over the best interest of their constituents. The oil from this pipeline is going to contribute to the inundation of our coastline, the loss of coastal Louisiana, our homes, our rich culture, and the loss of coastal areas all around the world.
Tracy, what do you say to the argument that we're hearing in this hour that is going to come out somehow?
At some point, we have to take a stand and instead put our money and our resources into renewable green energy. Those are long-term jobs, and they're jobs that will take care of our environment and future generations.
And your antenna right up there on New Orleans, which knows the issues so very well. I want to get one more off the coast, if I may, on the coast, if I may. Tracy, thanks. Eric in Boca Raton, Florida. Eric, you're on.
Tracy said it very well, but I'd like to take it one step further, if I may. I'd like to know whether or not Kerry himself has actually taken into his calculus about the about the diplomatic relationships that will start to sour between the United States and Canada when cities of Miami, New Orleans, and other kinds of cities up and down the coast will start suing Canada because of the actual results of the of the burning of the all these fossil fuels. According to the scientists that I've heard, they will actually add to our environment 400 parts per million. Literally, it will double the CO2 content in our atmosphere and literally exasperates the melting of the polar ice caps, Greenland, and everything else faster than we've already doing right now. Or maybe these cities should actually start suing the federal government to start forcing them to buy properties down here by eminent domain because of the lack of leadership and failure to take responsibility for what they are doing to the folks down here on the coast.
Eric, I appreciate your call. Tony Horowitz, mm-hmm. You hear the passion of people right there mm-hmm. on the seas
sure.
that, yes, are rising and projected to rise a lot more when they feel that, look, this is coming. In spite of the potential implications of that, really?
Mm-hmm. I would make a few points. I'll try and do them quickly. One of the things he touched on was diplomatic relationship with Canada. And I think this is going to be part of Kerry's thinking. Canada is our largest trade partner, our closest ally. And they, obviously not all Canadians, but the government and most Canadians want this pipeline. So that's going to weigh into this decision. On the climate change impact, again, I would come back to the drug, in this case, drug war analogy, where we have tried to disrupt or curtail production and transport of drugs to this country. I think it's fair to say that hasn't worked very well because our demand is insatiable. And I think it's the same with oil. Unless we can really address our own demand, this oil will keep coming by one way or another. So I think really the focus needs to be on both, yes, renewables, using less oil, which actually we are, but also just, bringing down that demand, not just being more energy efficient, but really reducing our appetite.
But when of course, there's a move to do that. There's a longing in many quarters mm-hmm. to do that. And I know so many young opponents of this pipeline mm-hmm. so fired up to stop it. And yet, when I read your book, Boom, and your reporting from mm-hmm. up there, those big house-sized earth movers are moving. They're growling.
Right.
This thing's happening. Here's a little bit from Bill McKibben, of course, 350.org founder, who's been at the forefront of pushing back on this interview with Nation magazine about a year ago, saying this is This is the symbolic and practical moment right here in this decision.
This fight over the Keystone Pipeline, it's become the symbolic and practical proxy for doing something about the fix in which we find ourselves.
So how do you read it, Tony? You've seen the whole length of the pipeline's intended path. You hear the debate in this country. You've seen the machinery in motion up there. Where do you see this going?
Yeah, I think Bill McKibben is certainly right on the symbolic front. This has become a tremendous rallying point, and I would say it's not going to end. Let's say a couple months hence, Kerry, the president, et cetera, do approve this. I think if they do, there will be more restrictions or there will be new action against coal-fired plants. But let's say they approve it. This fight is going to go on. There's 350.org and others at the national level who are pledged to continue their resistance. A very high percentage of landowners in Nebraska have yet to agree to a right-of-way through their land for this pipeline. There are multiple lawsuits. Native Americans, I met Sioux activists who have pledged to, as one of them said, saddle up 1,000 horses to oppose this pipeline construction. So I think you're going to see this fight go on for a very long time, whatever happens in the short term.
Machinery in motion up in tar sands territory, a huge debate around the country, globally, over where we go with our energy future. Tony Horowitz has written in a new e-book about the entire length of the Keystone XL pipeline path, if and when it's ever built. It's called Boom, Oil, Money, Cowboys, Strippers, and the Energy Rush That Could Change America Forever, a long, strange journey along the Keystone XL pipeline. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Tony, you want to work up there?
No, thank you. It's a place I'm glad I visited and hope never to return, with apologies to any listeners in Fort McMurray.
Tony Horowitz, thanks very much for joining us today, Tony.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.